Hello, hello. Welcome back to another episode of Talking to Grandma. In this episode, we talked with mother and daughter Fran and Gabrielle Kutkov about their experience reclaiming their Italian heritage language after it was lost two generations earlier. Fran Kutkov grew up in Manhattan and worked for the NYC public school system for 25 years as an orientation and mobility instructor, teaching blind and visually impaired children how to negotiate their physical environments and use public transportation. She majored in English at SUNY Stony Brook University while studying for her master's degree at CUNY Hunter College. She taught English to adult language learners. She ran her first marathon at age 63 and has run four more marathons since then. Now retired, she enjoys writing, sewing, traveling with her husband, and teaching her cats how to give high fives. Gabrielle Kutkov is a Montessori educator and the creator of Multilingual Montessori website and Instagram account, and the host of the Multilingual Montessori podcast, which is amazing. Y'all should check it out. She is an AMI-trained 3-6 Montessori guide and has worked in schools in NYC, Italy, London, and Austin, Texas. She holds a bachelor's degree in Italian from Vassar College and a TESOL certificate from Teachers College, Columbia University. As a recipient of a Fulbright grant, she spent a year teaching English to Italian high schoolers in Catania, Sicily. She has a Master's of Science in Child Studies from Linköping University in Sweden. We're excited to have an intergenerational conversation here with Gabrielle and Fran. Let's start with Fran. Can you tell us a little bit about your heritage language? What was your relationship to it, to your culture, and how has it changed over the years?
Well, I was born into an Italian-American family and was not taught Italian as a child, although I heard it all the time. In fact, when I was a child, I thought that I would grow up and when I got to be an old lady, I would speak Italian because all the old ladies in my neighborhood spoke Italian. And my parents spoke Italian to each other as their private language. And it never occurred to me until I filled out your form that Italian must have been my father's first language. He was born here, but his parents came over as adults and he must have been spoken to in Italian all the time, but I never thought of him as a native Italian speaker. My mother and father spoke to each other, and I thought of her as the immigrant because she was, but that I just thought he spoke Italian like a person who had learned it here. And then when I was filling out the form, I thought, oh my God, he was a native Italian speaker, but I never even thought about it. We teased her, you know, she was clearly a person who had learned the language as a second language. And there were certain words she said that were not correct. And we teased her. It was like, you know, her children would imitate her and call the post office the post office. You know, just like little things like that, which I find now that I'm an adult and I've tried to learn Italian, I find it insulting. But I didn't really have any interest in speaking Italian, nor did I have much interest in my mother's Italy to America journey or how she established herself here. And it really wasn't until Gabrielle was a child and started asking me questions, and my mother was already gone, and I couldn't answer her questions. I had no interest in speaking Italian, but when Gabrielle started learning Italian, I got an interest in it. I thought I was Italian until I went to Italy, and then I realized, no, I'm Italian-American. I just felt so un-Italian the first time I went to Italy. And, you know, we had the American culture infused deeply with the Italian culture. I lived in an all-Italian neighborhood. There were sections of the neighborhood, like all the Sicilians lived on these two blocks, all the Napolitans lived somewhere else, and there were divisions.
What part of the U.S. was this? Was this in New York?
New York City and Little Italy.
Okay. Oh, okay. So in Manhattan, in Little Italy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very, very, very clearly marked which town sent their immigrants to which section of the city, because of course when you came over, there were people there from your town and you just lived with them, among them. My mother and father met each other. They lived on the same block, not the same building. And that's just the way it was. There were little enclaves of neighborhoods that had all the people from one town.
That's amazing. That I feel like that story is so interesting to just place it historically in Little Italy too, to have this very, you know, Italian experience, but also to realize that it's very Italian American once you go back to Italy and are able to feel that difference. It's also really cool to be reintroduced to your language through your daughter. What was that experience like?
It was you know, it was her undying curiosity when she was, I don't even know how old she was, a child, maybe 10 or 11. We went to Ellis Island and she was so interested in the entire immigrant experience that I started being curious too. And then she went to college. You know, she went to a school that was predominantly Chinese, and she just longed to speak a different language. We would pretend, sometimes we would go out when she was a kid, we would pretend to be from England and we would speak to each other in British accents, or the closest we could come to, because she just longed for some different language in her life. And all her friends spoke Chinese, not all, but many of her friends spoke Chinese as well as English, and were interpreters, in fact, for their parents at school events. So when she started learning Italian, I started wanting to also, and I took Italian lessons at night. And then she had it was a summer program in Siena. And I'm embarrassed to say this, but I went to Siena too, and I enrolled in a 3-week program in Italy. And pretty good. I think I placed higher on the entrance exam than I should have, because I was really struggling with all the class things. But as far as conducting daily life, I could buy shoes, I could buy groceries. I was a little intimidated at the train station because, you know, with a line of people in back of me, I was trying to get information and I wasn't dealing with patient people usually. You know, I love that experience of not being familiar enough to like just go on automatic pilot, and having to really struggle to understand and negotiate different things. So that was a lot of fun. And the people that I went to school with for those 3 weeks, they were from so many different countries that often the only language we could communicate in was Italian. So that was nice too.
Yeah. That's so interesting to explore what that is like to learn Italian or to learn your heritage language as an older, like, adult, and just dive into it, not from childhood. I always have thought and have experienced with other heritage language learners that learning a heritage language is different than just learning another foreign language. That maybe you have more of an emotional connection to the language, maybe because you grew up hearing it around you, or you grew up with some kind of inputs of the language, you have a little bit of a reference point that you might not have had. Did you experience any of that learning the language as an adult?
Well, I think the music of it was in my ear, but I didn't feel comfortable enough to let it go. And I was very hesitant. But even in English, you know, I pause and I say things, but in a foreign language, it's even worse. But I think the music definitely was in my ear. I felt more comfortable. I remember being at a train station in Naples. Apparently, I wasn't speaking with a Sicilian accent, but interestingly enough, the Sicilian that my parents spoke no longer even exists. Like, I remember my brother was trying to learn Italian, and he would say to my mother, "How do you spell this?" And she said, "You don't spell it." What do you mean you don't spell it? But I don't think it was a written language initially, maybe in her day. And then I do remember, I just recall one thing as a child. I did want to learn Italian because I remember my mother had this little green book. I almost feel like it was called Voyages in Italian. I don't know, but she would sit with me at night and try to teach me, but it was from a book. It wasn't conversational. So So it meant nothing for me, and I just got bored and gave up. But I was little, you know. I did know some Italian, but they were mostly commands, like sit down, eat and be quiet, get to the dog, go to sleep, mind your own business. I know all those words, but and also terms of affection, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. I feel like that's universal and kind of second, third generations that are holding on to their language have little bits of it that they maybe know just those commands, the simple words. That was my experience growing up. Like I knew, sit down, be quiet, don't touch that. You're going to break that. Like also, I love you, things like that. But yeah, thanks so much, Fran, for sharing that story of, you know, your journey with your heritage language. And Gabrielle, we got to hear a little bit about your role in that. Can you share with us your relationship with your heritage language, how it might be similar or different from your mom's, and how it's changed over the years?
Yeah, so I grew up in the same neighborhood. I also grew up in Little Italy, but in the 90s. So it was very different by then. Not as many Italians, but I do remember groups of old women sitting in beach chairs on the sidewalk. And I would walk by, like, I mean, I was probably 4, maybe 5 years old, and I would walk by and they would all know who I was younger. And they would be like, oh, you got, look at you, you got so big. And like, I wouldn't know who they were. So that's kind of what I thought of as like Italian slash Italian American. It was kind of the same thing in my mind at that time. And so Little Italy neighbors Chinatown. And like my mom said, I went to elementary school in Chinatown. Many of my friends spoke Chinese to their families. And I always felt like I was missing out by not having another language. And I knew that my mom's family was from Italy. And I remember asking, well, why don't we speak Italian? I never wanted to learn Chinese because I knew that that wasn't my family's language. I wanted to learn my family's language. Why don't we speak Italian? And I remember going to Ellis Island. I think I was in fourth grade because I remember I bought a necklace that said Italy, like in beaded letters in the Ellis Island gift shop. And I wore it to class. And my teacher, who nobody really liked, was like, oh, did you go to Italy and get that necklace? And I was like, no. Did somebody buy it for you from Italy? No. And I just didn't explain that it was from Ellis Island. So I remember that was fourth grade. And I was very, very interested in our family history. Also, because my grandmother was the same age as I was at that point when she had moved. I remember that I was 9 and she was 9 when she had moved from Italy. And so I think that's also why I was so interested in her story. But my mom didn't have many details to share with me. And when I went to middle and high school, they didn't offer Italian as a foreign language. So I studied Spanish and then I studied French. But I was always interested in Italian. So when I got to college, I could finally study Italian. And that was one of the classes that I knew from the beginning that I was going to take. And I ended up majoring in Italian, not really knowing where that was going to take me or what I was going to do with it, but I knew that I loved taking Italian classes. I studied abroad. First, I did this summer program in Siena that my mom ended up also taking classes in Siena. I remember her asking me if it was okay if she also was in Siena at the same time, because I was, you know, between freshman and sophomore years of college, like I was just starting to have a more adult relationship rather than a teenage relationship with her. But I said it was okay. But sometimes we would be walking through Siena and one of my friends would be like, oh, look, there's your mom. but I liked that she was excited about Italian too. And then I studied abroad for a semester in Bologna. My mom wasn't there for that. And I, you know, met a few Italian friends, but I wasn't really, we were still very much like in our American student bubble, even though we were taking classes in Italian. So it really wasn't until I graduated and then I did a Fulbright teaching English in Catania, Sicily, that I really got to have a relationship with Italian where I was using it in a social context. And I mean, that was amazing. I mean, it was certainly a struggle, but it was really exciting to feel like I really spoke Italian. One thing that I remember about actually studying abroad, my parents came to join me for Christmas after the semester, and we were in Bologna, and I went into a store and bought something, and we came out, and my dad looked at me and he was like, "You speak Italian." And I was like, what do you think I've been doing here for the past 4 months? You know, of course I speak Italian. But I just remember him being so surprised and shocked that I was speaking in another language. And that made me feel like, wow, I really do speak Italian. I've really come a long way. But I remember, as far as the connection to the language and culture, I do remember being kind of indignant that we didn't have Italian citizenship, which is a story I can tell later, which now we do, but it was kind of a long and winding road to find out that we could. So at that point, when I was in Bologna and then Catania, we didn't have citizenship, and I felt like I wanted more connection to Italy. You know, the language wasn't enough. Living there wasn't enough. I wanted more of a connection. And to the Italian-American versus Italian piece, it's interesting because I grew up around so many Italian-Americans, but then when I went to Italy, I also felt that same thing that my mom was talking about of how different it is. And now that I've spent so much time in Italy, I almost feel more of a connection to Italy and Italians in Italy than Italian Americans, which, not to offend any Italian Americans listening, but it is a different culture. And also, you know, sometimes the way it's portrayed in movies and TV is not so flattering, and I don't really feel much of an affinity with that. So now I feel like I am more connected to Italy today, which is interesting because I'm sure that my grandparents were not, and maybe didn't even want to be connected to Italy anymore. But I often think when I was going through the process of getting citizenship, I often thought about my grandparents who I never met and what would they think about all of this trouble that I was going through to get Italian citizenship when they and their families just wanted to leave and come here.
Yeah, it's so interesting, the many different layers and variations of culture, right? That you have, like, it's a spectrum of what it means to be, like, Italian is not a monolith, what it means to be Italian American is not a monolith, what it means to be Italian American who then goes back to live in Italy for a long time. Like, there's just so many different ways that you can experience your culture and how that manifests. And in Spanish, we have, like, a term that I feel it really captures it. And then an iteration on a term that someone shared with me that I like, it is ni de aquí, ni de allá, not from here, not from there. And just kind of this idea of living in between both worlds. But someone also shared de aquí y de allá, from here and from there, which I think also just captures, like, the sense of belonging in all of these places. So it sounds like you had a bit of that experience having grown up in this very kind of Italian community neighborhood, one of the most Italian iconic neighborhoods in the US, and then being on this, you know, journey. And you mentioned with your grandparents of, like, what would they even think about you, you know, going back and reclaiming this part of your identity. What did you learn as a part of that process in learning about your familial history and the process of getting Italian citizenship?
I had to do a deep dive to find all of these records that we didn't even know my great-grandparents' names when I started this search, but we ended up having to, you know, find their birth and marriage certificates from these towns in Sicily. And we did know the names of the towns in Sicily, which I think we had found out years ago from
on a census.
And also a ship record, maybe. You can view ship passenger lists on ancestry.com. Mm-hmm. So I think we had found out that years ago. But what's interesting about Italian citizenship is that there's no generational limit, but if somebody in your line naturalized as a citizen somewhere else before they had children, the line is cut off. So my grandmother, my mother's mother, was from Sicily, and she came here when she was a child, and then she became a U.S. citizen before she had children. So we couldn't use her as, you know, the citizenship line. So I thought, I mean, that in itself is interesting because, so until I think 1992, Italy didn't allow dual citizens, and that citizenship just like wasn't really, it was a concept, a legal construct at that time, but I don't think anybody really thought about it. In their day-to-day lives. Like, they just wanted to become American. It didn't mean anything to have dual citizenship or U.S. You couldn't have dual citizenship, but to have Italian citizenship, I don't think that meant much emotionally. Like, they really wanted to become Americans. And it seemed, when I was looking at the papers, that people did that as soon as they could. Like, she was in her early 20s when she naturalized as a U.S. citizen. So we ended up, years later, I found out when I restarted this process, I found out that we could go through my grandfather, who was born in the U.S., because we could go through his parents, who were born in Sicily. So they were the ones that we didn't know anything about. And it was just, I was very excited to find out all this information and do all this research. But for so long, it was just their names and, you know, the facts. And I've kind of become the family historian. Like, I'm certainly not the oldest one of the cousins, you know, but I'm like the one, if people want to know who's who, I'm the one who knows all the information. But it's, you know, it wasn't until I think after I had completed this process that I then saw a picture that my older cousin had hanging up in her house of my great grandparents, my grandfather when he was a child. So this was like maybe 1900, maybe 1903, something. It was a very long time ago. I had never seen this picture before. And it was the his parents, who were like the original people that we used to go through for citizenship, and all of their children. And I felt like they were like celebrities because I had read all of their life events and submitted all these documents. And I felt like I knew them, but I'd never seen a photo of them. So that was a really cool experience. I was like, oh, look at them. They were real people. Who would have thought it was crazy that I was going through all of this trouble to get Italian citizenship? And it was just, it made me feel more connected to my family history, to, you know, actually know the details of it. I had thought that, you know, they came from little, poor little mountain towns in Sicily. I would have thought, I had thought that, you know, Italy didn't keep records like that, like, oh, the information won't even be there. And I, you know, I learned that Italian records go way back. The church records go back sometimes to the 1500s in some places. Like, they have very, very good record keeping, which I was impressed with. So it was just a really kind of validating process to feel like I knew the story of at least one line of my family background. We didn't do my mother's side then because we didn't need their papers, but then when I visited these towns, we did look up more into my mother's side and find out more names and dates, you know, birth and everything. And so that was, it's just exciting to, even if I don't know what their lives were like, it's exciting to feel like I have more of a connection even just by knowing their names.
What was that experience like then, doing all of this research, knowing their names, and going to the towns where they lived, where they came from, where their, you know, culture is situated? What was that like for you?
Yeah. I mean, I felt like I was, like, I had read the names, Marineo and Bolognetta, these two little towns. I'd read these names so many times that I was like, oh, I couldn't believe that I was finally there, like seeing the name on the street sign. I was like, I made it here, because they're not that easy to get to. Even when I lived, so I lived in Catania for my Fulbright, and these towns are on the other side of the island near Palermo, but about a 30-minute drive. And of course, I didn't have a car. Not many of my friends had a car, and I never made it there. So they weren't that easy to get to. So that was exciting to even make it there. You know, I thought a lot about, so they're in kind of the hills, and there's one part, we actually found the address of the house that my grandmother was born in because it was on her birth record. So we went to that little house. Nobody lives there. We joked about me buying it. We'll see. it's like a little, like kind of like rundown house. Yeah. but it's right around the corner from a medieval castle fort, which was beautiful. And then you can go in that building. It's like a museum now. So you go in and the balcony is, it looks over this valley and it's just like these rolling hills. And it was so beautiful. You can see the sea in the distance. And I just thought about, I'm sure they were very poor. And of course, there was a reason that all the, you know, immigrants moved and left their hometown. You know, I'm sure their life wasn't idyllic. But I thought about my grandmother at age 9, having lived this pastoral life, going to New York City in the early 1900s, which was not a great place to be in the on the Lower East Side, you know, and I thought it must have been, even just like in the quality of light, it must have been so much sunlight in Sicily and then these dark tenement buildings. So I thought about what that must have been like for her. You know, I'm sure they had more opportunities, hopefully, in the U.S., but it was, I think, geographically must have been a big adjustment. And one thing that was really interesting about Marineo is there's this big rock, like this big rock that sticks out of the top of the mountain. And it kind of, you can see it from almost anywhere in the city and in the town, it's not a city. And someone there was describing to me how everyone in Marineo feels this like emotional connection to this rock. It's like their motherland, but like literally they feel like it's, you know, like a parental figure. And I had never heard of that before. And I wondered a lot about that and whether my grandmother was too young to feel that. Maybe her parents had felt like they were leaving this like rock that had been like overlooked everything in the town. So it was interesting to hear people who live there now talk about it with such passion and emotion. Like this is like the mother rock, you know?
Yeah, that's beautiful. And beautiful for you to come back to that same space so many generations later to see where your family came from, to imagine what that journey must have been like for them to come to the US, just to deepen your relationship with that. I'd like to also kind of bring back the question that I asked your mom, Fran, about learning your heritage language as a heritage language learner. Like it's something that you have a familial connection to. Having learned other languages, like you said, it was French and Spanish that you learned. Did you feel a different connection to the Italian language? And if the process was different, how so?
I was just going to mention that, of course, on a very different level than you felt it when Gabriel had a person track down those records that we couldn't get a hold of in any other way. He was a Sicilian. He went to the towns and then he sent us pictures, many, many pictures. And I, when I saw the front of the house where my mother was born, I felt it viscerally. Like I just felt on a cellular level, I felt a connection. And I also had the same thoughts of how did she leave this majestic landscape to come to a tenement in New York City? It must have been so wrenching. And mm-hmm. then you think that that's a million immigrants have that same experience, you know? And mm-hmm. also as far as not knowing any of my heritage, she didn't want to talk about it. She wanted to be an American. And, yeah. and the past is the past, and she was moving forward in that. So there was a whole lot of her history that we didn't know.
Yeah. I do think a lot about how it's like a second or third generation privilege that I can have this fun relationship with Italian and, you know, go back not needing to move, but wanting to move and live there. And, you know, they didn't have the privilege of being able to maintain that connection because they really had to, or felt that they had to assimilate and really make a separation. And in order to make life better for their children had to sound like native English speakers, sound like Americans, act like Americans. And so it's really only you know, several generations later that often that you can go back and have more of a lighthearted, positive, enjoyable relationship with the language and culture because you don't need to move, need to assimilate. So I do think about that a lot. To your question before, I think I had a different eagerness and also desperation feels like too strong of a word, but like urgency to learn the language in a way that I didn't with other languages that I had learned. Like I wanted to speak it fluently immediately. And I think that was also motivation to keep learning it. When I lived in Italy, I could just walk around and look Italian. Nobody, which maybe I could also do in a Spanish or French speaking country. I mean, people are not monoliths, you know, but all of these cultures are diverse, of course, and Italian can look like many things, but, I have dark hair and I'm short and I looked like many people in Italy do. So when I was walking around in Sicily, if I didn't open my mouth, I would look Italian. And even when I spoke, I think I got to the point where I didn't sound American immediately. I didn't sound like a native Italian speaker. Of course, I had an accent, but sometimes people would guess like where I was from and it wasn't always America. So that always made me happy because I felt like I was, you know, starting to blend in. And I do remember also, I don't know if this is relevant, but as far as people looking a certain way, all of the Italian Americans that I knew kind of were darker complexion because they were from Sicily or Southern Italy, a lot of the immigrant groups that had come to New York. But when I lived in Sicily, many of my students were blonde or redhead, and that kind of opened my eyes to more diversity, you know, in Sicily. And of course there were, you know, second generation immigrants from like that of children that were in my classes when I taught there from other places, a lot of immigrants from Africa, because Sicily is very close to Africa. So it kind of opened my eyes to Italy now, looking much more diverse than the Italian American community that I had grown up around, because like my mom said, they all came from the same places because they moved, you know, where they had relatives. And even when you were talking about how your parents met, they lived on the same block. These towns that they're from are neighboring towns, like neighboring tiny little towns in Sicily. And they met here because they just, all of the people from the same place moved to the same place here. So I thought that was very interesting when I lived in Sicily.
In these last, you know, minutes as we start to wrap up, I'd like to just hear a little bit about where you both are now with this journey. So you've been on this journey with your language and reclaiming it as heritage speakers. How does that impact what you do day to day today? And I'll hear from you, Fran, first, and then Gabrielle.
I did keep all my Italian books, and I have fantasies that I'll work through them. And really, I'm kind of out of touch with Italian. It's really, even when I try to say, remember, simple sentences, it's difficult. And yet, I think if I were there, it would come back. But as far as on a daily basis, I don't have it at my fingertips.
But it's probably there, ready for your next trip to Italy.
But I do
have Italian passport.
I do have my Italian passport, and I think as my whole perception of Italian is different, is changed as a result of going there, and I have much more respect for Italy. I mean. Italy is an amazing country with so much art, and I didn't know that when I was growing up, because I just saw the daily struggles of Italian Americans who are leaving that behind, and there's a certain kind of rawness that was present in their whole demeanor, of like a fighting spirit, which was different from the Italians I met in Italy and there. Their intelligence. I didn't give that a second thought. I mean, I knew intelligent Italian Americans, but I didn't know that the art was so infused in their culture. I just didn't. You know, I mean, you know, Michelangelo, yeah. But, you know, it's all over. You walk down the street in Italy and it's just painted onto a building. It's just an amazing country and the architecture. So I have that shift in perception. And I don't know if I would have ever gone to, well, I had gone to Italy before, but it wasn't a deep visit. You know, I was a tourist. But I always had that change in thinking of myself as Italian to Italian American. There's a real difference there. So
that's beautiful.
Yeah,
Gabrielle.
So I do use Italian a little bit. So since I started Multilingual Montessori, where I talk to, so my background recently, you know, in the past decade has been as a Montessori teacher. And then I started Multilingual Montessori about 2.5 years ago to be resources for families who are interested in, you know, the connection and crossover between multilingualism and Montessori, since I had, you know, studied teaching English as a second language and then studied Montessori. And I, so in my work with that, I do think a lot about my own language experiences. And, you know, I learned Italian as an adult. So many families that I talk to are multilingual already and are hoping to raise their children multilingual, but some families are not yet bilingual and are trying to learn a language with their child. So that, you know, I often think about my relationship to Italian, and I'm not a parent, but if I were to become a parent one day, would I speak only in Italian to my child? I mean, that would probably be what I would advise somebody else to do, but gosh, I don't know if I would be able to do that, if I would feel that same emotional, I mean, English is my first language. I don't know if I could speak in a language that's not my first language to my child, even though I am pretty comfortable in Italian. It's a totally different thing when it's, you know, parent and child. So we'll see, you know, I'll see if that ever becomes a question that I need to ask myself. So I occasionally have the opportunity to use Italian in that context. But I'm actually going to Italy in 2 days on a work trip, which is really an exciting thing that I never could have foreseen. I worked for a Montessori school in Austin, Texas for 3 years, and then I moved back to New York, and I worked in the pre-K kindergarten class, but they go up to ninth grade, and they take their ninth graders to Italy every year. And when I was there, we talked about me doing Italian lessons, like travel Italian with the students, and it just never worked out because I was teaching full-time when they were in school. So it didn't work out. But once I no longer worked there, they invited me on the trip to go as kind of the Italian language and culture person. And so not only to be the trip's translator when that need came up, but also kind of to be there as a person that could talk to the students about what it was like when I lived in Italy, what like the cultural things that they might be seeing mean and what life in Italy is like today, which it's been a couple of years since I lived in Italy. So even I don't even always know what life in Italy is like today, but that has been a really cool experience. So I went last year for the first time and our trip is coming up, you know, the next 2 weeks. And so I get to show these 14 and 15 year olds, many of whom have never left the country, some of whom have never been on an airplane before this trip. And I get to share Italy with them, which is really amazing. And it was so cool last year to see them experiencing it for the first time and to kind of inject my experiences and insights or what I perceived would be interesting to them. So that was a really cool experience, and I'm excited to do that again. But, you know, when I got Italian citizenship almost 5 years ago, 4.5 years ago, I thought I would move to Italy or somewhere in Europe immediately. And I didn't. And part of that, of course, was the pandemic. But I still haven't moved. And I think about that a lot. Like, do I really want to move? Like, do I want to live in Italy, et cetera, now that I don't have that pressure of having to find a work visa, but it's really nice to have this opportunity to go back and have like a different relationship with Italy, even if I'm not living there right now. So it's special for me, and I hope that it's great for the students as well.
Yeah, I think that's going to be such a great experience. And even though you're not living abroad in Europe, you are in a country that desperately needs the work that you're doing with multilingual Montessori, because the rest of the world is incredibly multilingual and bilingual, right? And the U.S. Yes. is uniquely not, in that we have less than 20% of the adult population being identifying as bilingual, speaking more than, you know, two languages. But what we do know is that children coming into pre-K and schools, about 33% of them speak their home languages or another language other than English. And so you're just in such a, you know, great position in these early grades to be able to talk to families about what it takes to build out those environments, to sustain them through, you know, the middle and high school years. So also, I'd just like to, I know that there's a lot of alignment in what we do at the Language Preservation Project and what you're doing at Multilingual Montessori, but can you tell us a little bit about how you think this approach to bilingualism is a different approach and perhaps a more sustainable approach to building multilingual early childhood environments?
Yeah. So in Montessori, we often say follow the child, and that means looking at each individual child and meeting them where they are. And so I extend that to language learning and meeting each child where they are, whether that is, you know, helping them develop two or more languages from birth or introducing a second language, you know, at, you know, once they're in school. And I think that, I mean, I talk a lot about like Montessori language development principles and how they relate to multilingualism. But I think that the biggest overarching theme is that every person's an individual and we're meeting them where they are. So every family is bilingual or multilingual. Routine will be different. And I try to help each family kind of navigate their own journey and, you know, not fall too far into the comparison trap. Every little bit of bilingualism or multilingualism we can offer a child is wonderful. You know, I think a lot of parents put pressure on themselves that if it's not going to be perfect, is it worth it? Or if they're not going to be fluent, is it worth it? And yes, it is worth it. And so I think that meeting each family where they are and encouraging people to, you know, not judge their journeys compared to others and kind of meeting themselves where they are is important. Every bit of bilingualism we can offer a child is amazing. And I think that I hope that encourages families to keep trying even when it seems difficult. And another thing we talk about in Montessori is that development is not linear. So it might, you know, come in fits and starts. You might see a lot of gains in your child one week, and then you might not see gains for another 2 or 3 weeks, but that doesn't mean that they're not growing and progressing and developing. So yeah, I see a lot of overlap. I also, you know, see a lot of bilingual Montessori schools in Europe and not that many in the US. So I also try to encourage parents to kind of ask for that in their school if that's something they're interested in, and to not feel like they, if they're not native English speakers, to not feel like they have to speak English to their children before they go to school, because children pick up languages so quickly that it really is so important for families to maintain their own languages at home, because that's the language that's going to be more at risk once a child starts school. So that's not really specific to Montessori, but I really try to talk a lot about like preserving that home heritage language or languages for as long as you can, as much as possible, because like, you know, in my mother's generation, or I guess her parents' generation, the idea was, well, the kids have to speak English immediately. And, you know, if they don't speak English, they'll be at a disadvantage. And if they speak another language, they won't speak English well. And now we know that that's not true. And so I try to encourage families to preserve their own languages as much as possible, as long as possible, because children will pick up English or whatever the majority language is. And it's just so essential to have that cultural connection too. I think that you and I are talking about how we didn't really have that connection, and accessing our heritage language helped kind of restore that connection, but we can offer children that from a young age, which I think is a beautiful thing.
We are doing the very good work with many families and schools. I'm so happy with everything that you're offering as resources with Multilingual Montessori. Where can people find out more about that work? Because we could have a whole nother episode on all of the goodness that you're doing there, but where can folks find out more about that?
Yeah, so my website is multilingualmontessori.org. My Instagram is multilingual.montessori. That's where I post a lot of kind of like shortened versions of shareable information. And I have a podcast, which you were just a guest on, called the Multilingual Montessori Podcast. And I interview educators and parents and researchers, experts about bilingualism, multilingualism, Montessori. It kind of sometimes people have things to say about all of those topics and some one or a couple, but that is more for hearing the stories. And then if you want kind of the information and research, head to the website.
Thanks so much. Everybody check that out. You will definitely walk away with more information, new learnings, and a lot of new resources and insights. As we close out this really wonderful, beautiful, intergenerational, I think, you know, beyond many generations, because we brought your ancestors into this space from many, many generations back. Thank you so much for bringing us this joy, this conversation. And as we close out today, we'd love to ask you to share with our listeners one thing that is bringing you joy these days. And Gabrielle, let's start with you and then we'll hear from Fran.
Packing for my Italy trip has been bringing me joy. Thinking about what book I'm going to buy in an Italian bookstore has been bringing me joy, because you can find Italian books here, but they're often expensive and they don't always have the titles I want. So I've been plotting my trip to a bookstore in Rome, and that has been bringing me joy.
Beautiful. Fran?
Well, I've been writing a lot. I've taken memoir classes over the years, and I haven't really ever consolidated all those memoirs. And I'm continuing to write new ones in two classes that I have. And, you know, a lot of it takes place in Little Italy. I grew up in a grocery store, and a lot, that's the setting for a lot of them. And then a three-room tenement apartment is the other setting. And just remembering and reliving those days. And, you know, you start at one point and you remember a whole scrapbook of other memories that are there, which if I didn't sit down and do it, I wouldn't remember. So I really love it. You know, I can't do it enough, but I have other responsibilities too.
Well, thank you both so much for sharing the power of remembering and the joy that that brings us. And we're so grateful to have had you on as guests today. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for having us.
Yeah,
this is great.
Thanks for this opportunity.
Thank you so much for tuning in today. If you liked what you heard, take a minute to share this podcast with a friend or colleague. Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast platform. Your ratings and reviews help us to keep the podcast lights on. We can't do this without your support. Every subscription, share, follow, download, and review makes a big difference and helps others find our show. Also, we love hearing from you. Tell us what you think of the podcast. Email us at hello@thelanguageproject.co. You can also slide into our DMs on Instagram at Talking to Grandma. Talking to Grandma is owned by the Language Preservation Project. Rebecca De Leon is our editor and producer. The artwork for Talking to Grandma was created by Nancy Guevara, and I'm your host, Dr. Veronica Benavides. See you next episode.